As long as there are money printers, there can be no freedom of expression. Money is the tool we use to express value to each other. Whoever controls the money supply controls the world. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Welcome to all the new listeners. We've had another pretty huge uptick in the last couple of weeks. Thank you for enjoying. I'm glad you guys are getting value out of the show, and it is awesome to see. Thank you all so much. I love doing this, and it encourages me to keep going. And we have a great piece from Bitcoin Magazine today. And the incredible Knut Svanholm on the separation of money and state. Now, there's something I love about Bitcoin is how many different perspectives, particularly in certain areas, religion being the one I'm currently referring to, that can fit the truth, quote-unquote, of Bitcoin. Knut is very anti-religious in this sense, whereas I come from more of a anti-institutional religion sort of perspective. I find religious questions some of the most interesting worth asking in the context of like meaning and human life. I'm a big fan of Jordan Peterson, actually, in that way. The religious journey is a journey of discovering what it means to be human. And for example, there are a lot of people who are religious and find fundamental religious principles kind of being codified in Bitcoin. A good example would be Thank God for Bitcoin, the book. It's actually very, very new. I highly recommend it if you are kind of that persuasion. I've had a lot of people tell me it's great, and I don't have it yet, but I've got it in my Amazon cart. But at the same time, there's also this atheistic perspective on Bitcoin, in the sense that it removes the concept of authority or divinity in kind of an agnostic sense of monetary truth. And Knut likened it to financial atheism in Sovereignty Through Mathematics. And I think it was in that one. I think it was in his first book. But he has a chapter focused on it, and I thought it was really fascinating. There's so many good little tidbits and ideas that he hits there. So Knut always does a good job of articulating that perspective, I think. And in this piece, he kind of covers the broad strokes of the separation of church and state and what it succeeded at, where it failed, and why the most important thing Bitcoin can do is kind of close the circle with the separation of money and state. And then I get into it with Guy's take on this episode, so stay tuned. Real quick, before we jump into the read, I want to thank our two hella awesome sponsors, the Bitbox hardware wallet, and the many other backup and key securing tools at shiftcrypto.ch. Bitbox is secure, simple, sleek, open source, and very intuitive from start to finish. I've been using it for a long time now, and it's just been great. And just a PSA, if you ever buy, don't buy from a retailer. Buy directly from the manufacturer and check your URL. Really, really important. Discount code GUY gets you 5% off the Bitbox. Then, of course, the automatic, set it once, and it runs forever, Bitcoin savings plan, Swan Bitcoin, and that is with one N, swanbitcoin.com/guy. Lowest auto buy fees in the biz. Don't look at the charts. Don't try to time the markets. Don't stress. Just stack sats automatically while you sleep, while you're doing the dishes, while you're on vacation. It just does it automatically. swanbitcoin.com/guy. Okay, let's get into today's read, and it's titled Bitcoin and the Separation of Money and State. Throughout recorded history, religion and power have been inexorably linked, but Bitcoin now offers a beacon of hope. The separation of money and state is the most important change to society ever. Why? Let's rewind the clock and find out. Throughout recorded history, religion and power have been inexorably linked. The collective belief in one or more divine entities is very powerful. It enables humans to form larger groups than other primates. Dunbar's number represents how many people with whom one can maintain relationships. Without collective beliefs, human tribes could not have exceeded this number. Thus, civilization needs a belief system at its core. Belief systems provide human leaders with motivational tools. The introduction of ceremonial burial was one such tool. With ceremonial burial came the promise of an afterlife. This tool enabled tribal leaders to start wars with other tribes. Other primates fight each other too, of course, but outright war is a different thing. War has a supposed purpose for the collective. Despots could now trick their subjects with the promise of a better life after this one. This gave them immense power, since they could now rally armies to further their causes. It enabled them to form nation-states, controlled territories with loyal citizens living in fear of the armed forces. Because of people's beliefs, the divine right of the ruler became a part of their operating system. For centuries, this was the basis of governance for almost all nations. The ruler's supposed closer connection to the gods legitimized them in the eyes of the people. Then, the colonization of the Americas introduced a new problem for the ruling class. People from different religious backgrounds needed to band together in the new states. Enter the ideas of English philosopher John Locke. Locke argued that the realm of individual conscience was a personal thing. Thus, the liberty of conscience had to remain protected from any government authority. Locke's ideas had a huge influence on America's founding fathers. Religious tolerance became the norm in the New World. Thomas Jefferson wrote that the government should, quote, make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. These ideas made their way into the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, you know, the one about protecting freedom of thought and expression. Similar developments were happening throughout Europe. Today, almost all Western democracies call themselves secular states. Freedom of thought propelled humanity forward in unprecedented ways. Claiming that the Earth revolved around the sun wasn't a crime anymore. The dogmatic thinking of the church was no longer a burden on scientific progress. The ideas of the Enlightenment had finally emerged victorious. Humanity had abandoned superstition. The elites could no longer fool people into submission with their lies. Or could they? Money and state. The institutions of the church and the state were no longer dependent on each other, true. But religious traditions were still dictating how these states operated. The Gregorian calendar remained in use, and Sundays remained somewhat sacred. So did Christian holidays like Christmas and Easter. Ceremonial burial is everywhere. An alien would most likely find the practice very odd. But most important of all, the belief in the state itself remained. For what maintains the state if not religious belief? What gives one man the right to govern another? Aren't these notions mere remnants of an antiquated belief system? Some of us think that they are. Some of us see no difference between the allegiance to God and the justification of a government. The most powerful tool of lulling people into a specific set of beliefs that exist today is money. With the introduction of fiat currencies came a new way of controlling populations. New methods to keep them enslaved. The central bank proved to be a much more powerful entity than the church could ever be. The thought of a better life after this one could make regular people do atrocious things to each other. The thought of a better life here and now could make people do atrocious things to themselves. It enslaved them in perpetuous work as they all strived to become rich an impossible goal for most people. As long as there are money printers, there can be no freedom of expression. Money is the tool we use to express value to each other. Whoever controls the money supply controls the world. The words, quote, "In God we trust," printed on every dollar bill in existence, gives a clue to how fooled we've been. We're not secular. We still belong to a cult. The emperors are still naked. There's still no such thing as divine right. If we want to become secular, we have to separate money and state. There's no middle ground here. People in charge of issuing currency can't resist enriching themselves. The incentives are too strong. There's no way around this. Never trust a piece of paper that says, "In God we trust." There's probably no God and definitely no we. But since 2009, we have had Bitcoin, a beacon of hope in an otherwise dark world, a peaceful way of disarming the sociopaths, a way of making violence a lot less effective. If you want your mind to be free, rid yourself of all appeals to authority. Take control of your destiny. Emancipate yourself. Don't let anyone dictate the course of your life. Amen. This is a guest post by Knuts von Holm. Opinions expressed are entirely their own and do not necessarily reflect those of BTC Incorporated or Bitcoin Magazine. All right, so there is a lot of... He hits a lot of little pieces or little concepts in this. Some that I want to push back on. Me and Knut kind of have a fun back and forth on the religion thing every now and then. And then some, obviously, kind of the core idea here that I deeply agree with. So we're going to get into it in just a second with Guy's take. But for just a minute, let's hit our sponsors really fast and we will come right back. Do you seriously not have a Bitcoin savings account with Swan Bitcoin yet? Okay, maybe you're in Europe or something. Okay, I get it, but otherwise, what the fuck? It's so fucking easy. You literally fucking sign up for it and then it just works. Are you stressing the fuck out watching 5-minute charts like you're gonna beat some Wall Street trading algorithms like a fucking noob? Why? That's like working full time to give your sats to somebody else. Bitcoin returns are the highest fucking returns of any asset in the fucking world for the past 10 years. Why are you trying to beat the best performing asset ever? Just buy it while it's in 5 digits. Low fees, easy to use, f***ing automatic. Swan f***ing Bitcoin. And use my referral, swanbitcoin.com/guy, and you even get sats with it that are f***ing free. Just do it. This ad was not approved by swanbitcoin.com. Okay, so the framing of this, the idea of the separation of money and state. This is the most important aspect of Bitcoin. This is the reason it is decentralized, and it's what it means to establish a new non-authority-based, a consensus-based monetary good. This is the ultimate problem to solve. And even more so important because so few understand exactly the size of its problem. Just how enormous the consequences are of having our money attached to the state apparatus. I would bet money that, you know, go back in history when we're talking about the separation of church and state, which Knut starts this piece on, like the, you know, good analogy, the separation of church and state as a... system of authority, and here the separation of money and state in the same way. I'm sure it was incredibly difficult to even think about the idea of separating the church and state, and that almost no one around the world would even understand just how horrible the consequences of a church or a religious government truly were, because it was the default. They were the same thing. It wasn't that church and government should or should not be separated, or should have one should have this or one should have that. It was that the church was government, right? Like, it would have probably have seemed like we should separate coffee from the espresso. You know, the espresso is the coffee. Like, it wouldn't have made sense to to them in that time. But when, but on the question of religion, on the question of God or the afterlife or whatever, like, that's a personal question. You know, too many people think that you can just find it in a book, or that it could be dictated you by some guy or girl who just, quote, knows about these things, as if that other person isn't the same moron who yells at somebody who cuts them off in traffic, can't figure out which tax form to fill out, or why the hell gluten-free should, you know, should matter, or that someone has some secret info about the afterlife that the rest of us aren't privy to. No, they don't. Like, that person up on the podium is just a dude or a girl. Like, it's just it's the same as everybody else. Why would they know better? Your religion and what you believe about the nature of why, the reason life exists, how things originate in the universe, is a process of discovery. It's not something you cover in a list of bullet points. And clearly, which luckily has become the norm, the idea that one person could have a greater moral privilege or some divine right to do evil for good, that luckily that's in the context of religion and government, it's largely a thing of the past. But in a general sense, it's not. It's alive and well in just a different form. But anyone who could see, when you think about it in the context of religion, that someone has this religious privilege to rule over another person, that they have this divine right to force them into some situation or into slavery, clearly and obviously, the average person would say that's a profoundly dangerous belief. Anyone who knows anything about humanity would see how obvious that is. But look at the government, and what is it? That even though none of us have the right to steal or take from another person or to hurt another person, even though we pretend we are equal, somehow, if we get enough people together to agree to take the rights away from someone or to steal from them or hurt someone, it's okay? That there's some divine justification that, quote, the collective, whatever the hell that actually is, the we decided, maybe I can't steal from you, maybe no one else in the neighborhood is allowed to steal from you, but if we all agree that Bob is our representative and we conclude that it would be better for us if we all had your income, well, now we can steal from you? Somehow Bob has the right to do this on our behalf? Where did that come from? How's the whole neighborhood delegating a power that nobody in the neighborhood has? And by what delusion does it suddenly become moral for Bob to do something that is clearly evil in every other context, that is literally a form of enslavement? Why? Because you have more than somebody else in the neighborhood? What does that have to do with anything? Whether or not you have more, just in a flat sense, or that your yard is greener, or, you know, whatever the hell it is that we're talking about as a difference, that's not a moral question. It's about how we act in response to that that is a moral question. Now, if you stole it from somebody else in the neighborhood, yeah, but you have to prove that you stole it. That's the whole point of rights. Was someone else's right infringed upon to get it? And if they weren't, if you were just more productive or you worked harder on your grass, you watered it more or something, then how does anybody else have a justification? How does anybody, when the result of, when your results are just because you worked harder, you focused on it more, or maybe you got rain and the other side of the neighborhood didn't, irrelevant. That's not a moral question. That's just a shit, that sucks. But if that's the consequence, that you have greener grass, if you didn't take it from the other person, if it wasn't their labor that you stole, what possible right do they have to steal your labor to get themselves greener grass? Knut is absolutely right. It is a religious belief that there is such a thing as humanity, quote unquote, the collective, that's worth sacrificing humans for, or that there is such a thing as the greater good that's worth doing evil for. But break it down into its grains, like just itemize it out, and you realize both of these things are illusions. There is no collective, it's just thousands or millions of individuals. So there's no way to sacrifice individuals for the collective, because the collective is just individuals. The question is, what are you doing to the individual? What right does the individual have? And a silly hypothetical that I almost always hear brought up in response to something like this is some variation on like the two really bad choices and having to choose between them. So usually goes something like, I think the most common one probably that you guys would probably know about is an example like, let's say there's a train barreling down the tracks and there's two paths it can take. And on one of them, there's like 20 grown men and women tied down. So they're all adults tied down to the track. And if the train takes that path, it can't stop in time. It's certainly going to kill all of them. And then on the other track is one young child, same story. And you are standing at the switch to decide which one the train takes. So the question is supposed to suggest that one or the other is the greater good and you're supposed to decide. But in reality, this isn't a moral question. It's a value question. And it can go either way, depending on your thoughts, like your subjective valuations, which you value more. Does the child have a higher value claim because they never got a chance at life? Whereas the 20 adults have lived most of their lives? Or is it that the 20 adults collectively have more life to give and value still to create in the world, and therefore there is more life at stake on that track? You know, which is the greater loss of value? The moral question is whether this situation was natural or purposeful. The moral question is who f***ing tied everybody to the tracks? This situation is not at all, this supposed dilemma is not at all a justification for the government forcing or taking away the rights of a few to, quote, help the many, just because you can come up with an analogy where potentially one group of people having a cost could save the lives or help another group. The analogy supposes the evil has already been done here and that you've been put into a disgustingly awful choice against your will, and that everyone is already tied to the tracks. To suggest that the government has the right to hurt somebody for the, quote, greater good is to suggest that they should be allowed to tie people to the tracks in the first place, because maybe we could use their resources elsewhere that's more valuable than their right to live. The truth here is that the dilemma is, as it is proposed, if the only option is to hurt one person or another in order to help a third, when in reality, it's simply immoral to hurt people. And it is your obligation to figure out how to help someone morally, or you've done nothing positive for the world. You know, if the only way that I can help a child, like I can only give it to give them $5, is that I have to steal $100 from somebody else. Not only have I made the world nominally $95 poorer, I have poisoned the very concept of helping them and the very concept of what it means to be moral in the first place. That is how government is based on a false religion. It is the idea that an artificial choice that has been forced upon us by an immoral institution, in other words, who do we point the gun at, instead of why are we pointing a gun at someone, should be equated with the natural state of differences in people's situation. Like, this person isn't as smart, or this person isn't as beautiful, or this person was born in a bad place, or a storm hit this person's house and it missed this other person's house and, you know, just rained on their yard and made it green. These differences that exist from a natural probability in the nature of life in the universe are no one's fault. They're not a moral question. It's not moral that, or immoral that, somebody got just enough rain to make their lawn look nicer and another person got a storm that took their home from them. That's just bad luck. That's just the unfortunate state of the fact that nothing is the same anywhere and that reality exists and that it isn't under our control. To institute a system of violent force, a system of theft, a system of enslavement to, quote, help settle these differences, only creates an institution of evil. It only institutionalizes immorality, for which we will endlessly fight over what is subjectively worse, being ugly or being poor, losing your house or losing your car, being short or less than average intelligence. And it just becomes an endless contest of who has the greatest claim on being the most helpless so that they can justify tying someone else down to the tracks. It is not a question of which way the train is directed. It's a question over how many people and who exactly we are allowed to tie down and for which justification is it acceptable to do so. It is a question of which evil, not what is the greater good. And I've gone into this topic before and how this question is not a question of whose rights do we protect by saying somebody has the positive right to something, like the right to health care or education or something, when those are things that we would want people to have, but that it's not a right. This is a choice, any choice to eliminate one person's right to own their property so that someone else can have that property is actually elimination of everyone's rights to property. There's no middle ground here. Either you have a right to property or you don't. If there is some subjective reason why that can be taken away, it doesn't matter whether you're the recipient or the one paying the cost. The right to property is then gone because it's now a subjectively defined thing. It's just based on who's in charge and who has the greater, the more pathetic story as to why they should be the one that gets it. So this isn't about who gets the shaft and who doesn't. It's about whether anybody has the right to property in the first place. But I go into it really deeply on Guys Take 32, rights, incentives in the Bitcoin system, and how Bitcoin is actually a revolution in this context, because the rights themselves are not defined by an authoritative system. They are defined by a secret. They are defined by a cryptographic yes or no script. So it is not the judge or the president or the government or somebody's biggest claim on needing it more than someone else. That claim no longer has any hold. That's not the fundamental place where the right to property comes from in the Bitcoin system. And I really think I had a lot of people who gave me really good feedback on that episode. So I'll have that link in the show notes if you like this topic and kind of want to go deeper down that rabbit hole. Again, Guides Take 32. But all of this is kind of a long tangent to explain that the control of money is the very thing that is able to obscure the costs of this dilemma and make it so that we cannot see who got tied down to the tracks. That cost is hidden from us. It is everywhere around us, but there is no clear train. There's no obvious track and no clear person who got tied down. It's 100 steps removed from cause and effect, and all we see from the mutilation of the economic reality, the endless debts and the wealth confiscation of government with seemingly no cap or limit on it whatsoever, the endless meddling in every single industry, the price controls, the money printing, the ever greater deficits. All of these things are tied to the monopolistic control over money that government has. The economy is the means to all of our ends. Think of a single thing in your house that you did not get through trade. So, U.S., for example, there's an average number of somewhere around 300,000 things in an American home. Pencils, cups, bags, shoes, tools, shelves, phones, staples, e-cigarettes, Band-Aids, USB cords, whatever the hell. There's 300,000 things in the average household. Think about your house. Is there a single thing that you own that wasn't the result of trade? Say, even if you make your own candles or something like that, did you make the wax, the tools that you used, the glass jar? Maybe you carve little wood things. Did you make the knife? Maybe you even make knives. Did you mine the iron ore from the ground with your bare hands? Did you carve it with only natural light, or did you use a lamp? I'd guess, unless you have a pine cone or a leaf as a decorative item sitting somewhere, that you don't own a single thing that's of any value to you that did not require the skills, hard work, and trade with another human being. That is the power of money. It makes that trade possible. It frees the mechanism to communicate and exchange value accurately. And as a consequence of that role, the power to control money is the greatest power in our entire world. It is the power to manipulate narratives, the power of propaganda, to whisper your version of the world into everybody else's ears. It is the power to lie to you about the value of anything and everything, to make someone else buy a house because they are certain the market, in other words, everybody else's individual choice, is that it is more valuable, when in reality, it's that the market is being lied to and manipulated by the man controlling the levers of debt. You know, the ultimate resource, and we talk about this a lot, Breedlove has a number of great pieces on it, Derjiji, I mean, this is covered so many different times in so many different ways. The ultimate resource is time. And time is the resource of human life, of human labor, to be able to dedicate to something. How long do we spend on a thing? Does it call our attention? How much of our labor do we direct to it? How much of our intellect? How many people work toward it? All of those are ultimate costs of our time. The monopoly power over money is the power to consume limitless resources or limitless amounts of human life for someone else's ends instead of what those people would value independently. It is the power to shape other people's lives to your vision of the world and having to produce absolutely nothing in return for such a godlike privilege. The question as to who should have the central authority over money is the same as the question as to whether or not we should be tying down people to the tracks. It might not be as obvious, and instead of taking the entire lives of 20 people, it takes 1/2000th of the lives of 400 million people or 400,000 people or something, whatever the math is. And it's harder to see why they are struggling. It's harder to see where that life was taken, how it got lost, why they had to toil for 3 years longer than they otherwise would have, why their option to save took another decade to actually retire, why after 20 years, they're still in debt for an education that didn't even get them a decent job. Why that one broken leg seemed to cost an entire year's salary and it just hung on them and weighed on every choice and risk they were allowed to take for a decade. It's harder to trace back, but it all comes from the same place. The separation of money and state, the removal of this awful inequality, is the most important thing we can be focused on right now. Our economy is deeply imbalanced. You can listen to Preston Pish and me go at it in yesterday's episode, talking about just how absurd the financial markets are, and you know a lot of the consequences of, or a lot of the reasons that we actually got here. But ultimately, Knut, the concept here, the fundamental argument that Knut is making, that money and state should be as separated as the church and the state, is critical. Because for the same reason that a person with religious authority has no greater moral claim to do an evil thing, that simultaneously no government or, quote, representative should have the right to command the life and resources and time of another human being without that person's consent, without the cooperation and the knowledge of that person giving that cost. A really good one that for anybody new to the show, I know we've had a ton of new people recently. If you haven't read it yet, Breedlove's Masters and Slaves of Money is really, really great around this concept. So that's another one to dig into. And if you really like this piece, Knut has a lot of other great pieces. We even have his whole first book. He has two great books on Audible, both read by Mua, and I don't even know how many articles and pieces and stuff on this show, So definitely check him out. I've got his author's page up on the on bitcoinaudible.com, and of course you can just go to the library and type Knut, K-N-U-T, and all of his stuff will come up. So definitely check that out. Big thank you to Bitcoin Magazine for always hosting such awesome content. And before we get into today's Bitcoin resource, a quick thank you to my many patrons and the Audionauts in my Telegram group who have just made this show. You guys were there keeping this show alive when I wasn't making a dime and did this for 2 or 3 years just because I was consumed with it, and it still blows my mind how many people have gotten value out of this, and it makes me so happy to think that I helped people find Bitcoin and understand it. That's why I do it, and thank you guys so much. If you want to join the Audionauts, just any sort of tip or support, all I do is keep it to only supporters of the show, and you are immediately one of the elite. We just screw around and have a good time and talk about Bitcoin. But donate, become a patron, whatever, at guyswan.com, and that's all it takes. Shoot me a message, and I'll let you in. And of course, to our lovely sponsors as well, swanbitcoin.com/guy for my referral, which actually gets you free sats, so you want to use the referral. But Swan Bitcoin is the place for a no-hassle, automatic Bitcoin savings plan. Auto sat stacking for the win. And it doesn't hurt that they have the lowest fees to do so. And auto withdrawals. They batch and pay the fees on-chain for you. They'll send it straight to your BitBox hardware wallet automatically. And the BitBox is our other sponsor, Shift Crypto. BitBox is the open source, simple, easy to use hardware wallet for holding your own keys. Check them both out at guyswann.com, where you will find both of our sponsors. Okay, to close this one out, I want to talk about today's Bitcoin resource. A lot of people ask me how I use Lightning. I use Lightning all the time, and the dominant way that I use it is BTC Pay Server. So if you go to guyswan.com and do like an invoice or like do a donate thing, it all does it through BTC Pay. And then I also have Zap, which is Jack Mallers and their crew's Lightning wallet that he designed, connected to my BTC Pay, which was really easy. There's like a little services tab in BTC Pay that I can bring up, have a connection QR code. I scanned it, and then boom, my Zap was connected to my BTC Pay. I use it all the time. I've had, you know, channels open for like a year, and I barely had to do any real management of it. It usually just kind of takes care of itself. But I use Lightning all the time, and BTC Pay Server, I'll admit I had a lot of headache getting it set up originally. It was hard to find things at first, but after you get it set up, It works. And it has not given me the slightest bit of trouble outside of what I would literally chalk up to just kind of a confusing user interface. But after you do it, it's super simple to use. Every time you click on a thing, for some reason, it just continues to work and everything pops up, and I haven't really had to manage it at all. And it has been a wonderful, wonderful tool. And for any complaint that I have about it, it absolutely, the benefit of having it massively outweighs any potential headache it ever gave me. And it's my own payment processor. And I have like multiple devices connected to it. And it's just awesome. So check out BTC Pay Server if you have a website and you want to accept stuff for goods or merchandise and stuff on your website, or you want to make some fun little tool or a plugin or something for your website, anything like that. Like I sell on the cryptoeconomy.com, the holiday calendar. Again, that's the same BTC Pay Server. It's a really awesome universal tool, and you should definitely check it out. With that, thank you guys so much. This is Bitcoin Audible. I've got another great episode coming at you tomorrow, so don't forget to subscribe. I am Guy Swan, The Crypto Economy on Twitter. Check me out. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Cryptoeconomy Network.